Meeting to order, and Stephanie, can you do the roll call, please?
Susan Fowler, Tom Moore, Joe Omoasagie, Elaine Palencia,
here.
Kyle Patterson,
here.
Julian Rappaport,
here.
Jane Sprandel,
here.
Margaret White,
here.
Thank you.
You know what, we...
The presentation that we had scheduled to have during public participation is not going to happen. We'll send you out the students' final PowerPoint presentation. This is a group Chandra's been working with, so as soon as they're done, we can share the presentation.
I didn't want to kick Pat out of the chair. all right. Do we have any citizen input or public participation? Right. How about the approval of the agenda? Do you have a motion? Elaine?
I'll second it.
And second, Jane? Thank you. I should say all in favor. Okay, thanks. President's comments. I am just so grateful for our staff for the Mental Health Board. If you read their reports and you see all of the hard work that they're doing and juggling, balancing, working with the agencies, looking towards our future, working with us. And as I told Chandra today, I said, just to watch her in meetings, it's like magic. She can tie together everything everyone said. And so appreciate all of the hard work. Also, I so appreciate all the hard work that Pat Egge and her group has been doing, and we'll hear about them. I have to say, at first, I told Lynn this today, at first I was like, oh, we're giving them all that money up front. But wow, you have used it wisely and worked diligently to come up with the information you're giving. So thank you so much. And third on the agenda, I said, I'm so sad. This will be my last meeting, unless we have a meeting in December. My board term is up. I don't want to leave because I actually really love working with the board, and I'm kind of an information geek on social work and mental health issues. But I need to because I have to help out some family members in the next year, and so that's the place I need to be. But hopefully I will be back. So thanks. I've loved working with everybody. So thank you. So now Lynn's comments.
Thank you, Margaret. That was really nice. I think I will defer. I know I probably shouldn't do that all the time, but we have pretty many action items to get through, so I'll have some comments during that period anyway.
So next on the agenda is new business and the family model recommendation. So Cunningham will present. Thank you.
Okay, you should have in your packet slides, but they're also up for you. I found a few typos, so I fixed those. So please excuse those if you're one of those folks that look at those details. So what we're attempting to do is to consolidate the last 5 months of the effort that we put into planning for what is we term a family model. And I want to be really upfront. We diligently looked at more traditional family models, meaning structured, evidence-based, and we use the hexagon model, and you'll hear some of those pieces. We're going to try to hit highlights so you kind of see how we got to where we are today. And I just need to kind of say up front that it's been a long journey and a deep journey, and I, too, want to thank Margaret and Joe and Chandra and Mark for being a part of the stakeholders group. We put a lot of time and energy into meeting, updating, getting feedback, and it was truly a process. So I'm going to continue going through a couple slides. I have Monsi here, who's been a part of she's a part of the social work program, and I've been really enjoying having a sidekick to help me with a lot of things that I do at Cunningham, so that's been fun. And then Marie, I'm really happy to introduce you to Marie, who will be the coordinator over this program. One of the advantages, which I'm going to say up front, in being able to have this program start, is that we have people in place. oftentimes new programs, you're developing a coordinator, you're developing the program, you're developing and hiring people, you're figuring out where their offices are. We already have moved somebody and we're ready to go with space. I mean, we have been planning already and implementing, and that's really important to see. So I'm going to give you a timeline that's pretty quick, then we're going to get into the hexagon a little bit and talk about the actual model that we are wanting the board's approval for, and if you have questions at the end. So hopefully we'll make this. Joe, I thank you as well for stakeholder support. So here's a really quick version of the stakeholder process and the planning we did during those meetings and highlights. So July to present, the stakeholders have been meeting. We've been really focused on system of care principles, in particular trauma-informed and family-driven, not always seen in the juvenile justice system. So we thought that was a real important place that is a part of this grant. It's the foundation of what this grant is under in terms of the board. July to October, it was me, a little bit, Monsi was on some of the calls. I talked to 30-plus community members who interviewing them about PLL. This also includes a couple organizations who have done PLL program and are currently not, so I took in a lot of information about the pros and cons, in particular of our local folks, to get an understanding of what had been done. September, we had a long list of models, and the committee, stakeholders committee, helped us narrow to 5, which is still an extensive number to go into the exploration with the hexagon. September, October, that's when Marie and Monsi and I, as well as some internal people at Cunningham, did an exploration of the models and began to use that tool and begin to use the hexagon tool concept to give us a framework to compare. And then in October, Cunningham proposed to the stakeholders and this committee, or this board actually knew as well, that we decided to put the Juvenile Justice Family Program under the Intensive Placement Stabilization IPS program, or not really under, aside that program. And that again was because we have a coordinator, it was ready to go, we have people already trained in this model, and so we just thought it was a wise move in order to be able to implement a lot quicker. So ARC we'll hear a little bit more about later, and then that meeting, and I want to give Chandra some credit for this. She actually said, well, why don't you look at ARC as a model? I hadn't even thought about that. So we did. It's not a formal family model, but it is a trauma-informed model. And so that's what we're trying to, you know, move it closer. Oh, your microphone was kind of goofy, wasn't it? All right, so Monsi's going to talk about the hexagon tool and give you kind of the overview of how we use that.
So we try to use the hexagon tool. This is a tool that is used for assessing and analyzing specific models. It had 6 main indicators. There are 2 types of indicators. The first one was program indicators, which one of it was evidence. So it included everything like research, what kind of target population does the research include? Does the research have a diverse area of population that we are targeting to serve? The next one was support, so the level of qualifications that is needed, the training that goes into the model, the consultations and the supervision, how better are they available with these models? So that was the second part. The third part was usability, like how good is it, how user-friendly is the model, and are there some sites near our community that we can observe and learn something about it, and how is the structure of the model? So those was the program indicators more regarding the specific model that we are trying to research. The next one, the next category was the implementing site. So it was more regarding how Cunningham can implement these models that we were considering. First was capacity to implement. So we were trying to see if Cunningham has the staff, has the qualifications, and has the cost and data to implement this program. The next one was how the model fits with the programs that Cunningham already has or the programs that are already available in the community. And the need is basically the target population that we wanted to serve and also the juvenile justice focus that we wanted to have. So this was more regarding the implementing site and how it is fit or not a good fit according to the models. What we found out was the five or six models that we rated on these indicators that if the model was high on the program indicators, it was low on the implementing side. And the family models that we consider, like the TFCBT or MDFT or even PLL, those were very good in research background or even like training. They have a good, very good training and consultation background. So those were very high in the program indicators, while they did not fit into the implementing site indicators. That's what we found. And also these models had requirements such as master's level positions and licensed social workers, which considering the current workforce issues was not a good fit for us.
Thanks, Masi. Okay. That was a real short version of a very long part of the process, and it really was stark. And when we went to the committee here on the 5th and brought this information forward and had a really good, probably almost a couple of hours to dig into how we got to where we were, why we chose, we did not have a specific family model, number one, selected at that time. It was really showing that it wasn't moving in a great direction for implementing very quickly. For example, I mean, it could have, for some models, taken us a year to get trained up to be able to do it. Needing clinicians that have their license is way more challenging than anybody might think. So there were really a lot of challenges. So we were able to take that before the stakeholders meeting and had some great dialogue about that. And then the juvenile justice family model was confirmed to be into our IPS alongside the IPS program. We went into more details at that meeting with the stakeholders there to define how that would look. That's the meeting that you were at, Marie, and we get to meet Marie. Frankly, I will say oftentimes, I don't care what model you have to have the right people. And if people can't connect and don't have a full understanding of the direction that they're going and hear families and understand it through a trauma lens, it makes any model a challenge if you don't have that. So the ARC model is something we're currently using in the IPS program. And just to remind you, that program is being run through a DCFS funding at this point at Cunningham. It's a model where I'm going to give Maria a little bit of a chance to have the microphone to talk about that and ARC. But it is very, very family focused. It really meets many family members' needs. It's not a specific model. I will tell you a couple alarming things just at this point in time, and I shared it with the stakeholders. There were a couple family models that literally, well, that family really doesn't fit. And I don't mean it was one of those pieces that not too many families would fit. There were too many variables that made it challenging to say that the families fit. And some of the PLL components, that's some of the dynamics that came from that. And certainly I'm not criticizing the model or the previous program. It just was making it a challenge for, especially as Monsi said, in the workforce, it is really challenging to find folks with masters and being therapists, let alone on top of it having a clinical license, which many of these models required. The juvenile justice program that we will be performing and putting forward and implementing is clinical. Anything that is done in terms of therapy will be done by a therapist. The nice thing about ARC, as you're going to see, is that it has a broader perspective within the system, and I'll get into that a little bit later. But we will keep the program on a clinical focus. So that's real important to know that at the stakeholders meeting, we made that a strong point. We will meet with stakeholders. I will say this is now in the past that we've begun to meet with stakeholders. We've met with Julie Reitz and Ramona Sullivan from the public defender and the state's attorney side, Jonathan and Mike Williams. Mark was at that meeting, and we did a real deep dive into what the referral process would look like. We are clearly going to start with Jonathan's group at YAC first. Marie and Monsi and their team went over today without me and started meeting with the YAC, or the whole team. They had Marie was just totally impressed with that team. to be able to coordinate, and that's what this is about. It isn't about us being over on the side giving services, and so the stakeholders around the table that's been coming to the meetings, we now have met with many of them, talked to Regina on the phone, and so we've really pulled that group and really have appreciated that input. And then we already have had six people on Monday, not Tuesday, the 18th, come here to this room and look at the logic model. We began a whole big sheet to pull together on the outcomes and worked with Nicole Allen. And we'll begin to look at their consultation. Monsi's going to call their grad assistants. We're really in sync with them to begin to put that outcomes piece. I'll get into the ARC piece in a little bit, but I don't want to get too far into the weeds here. See that nice flip there? Monsi teases me about my technology skills, the lack thereof. So here's the recommendations for ARC, and to really just kind of put it on the line of what makes this strong, and it clearly is strong on the implementation piece. And I am extremely excited and got a lot of excitement from at least several of the stakeholders about this, including, I think, our staff that see the benefits of this particular. It's very, very trauma-informed. It has strong implementation indicators, but the potential with the program indicators are beginning to look strong. I'm going to switch over just a brief second. I almost promised myself I wasn't going to say this, but there are major changes coming out of the federal level and the state levels on the system of care from a DCFS perspective. And what does that have to do with juvenile justice? Every system ties together. A Family First Prevention Act that's coming out of the feds will transform what child welfare looks like. There's a clearinghouse that's beginning to look at family models and other models and looking at it from an evidence-based practice side. They're probably going to be very ready in the next year so we can actually use ARC as a foundation to start us, but then begin to look at other models that fit and how we might be able to bring that in. And Cunningham's looking at that. There's several organizations in the community in the county that's looking at that as well. But here's the thing that kind of sold us. Cunningham staff are already trained in ARC. Maria's trained. We have two therapists and a case manager trained. DCFS is doing it statewide with the ARC model. We are hopefully going to be able to tag on to some training in January with DCFS to have a few slots to even start with this program. It's lower in cost. I don't want to quote what PLL was, but the first year of this would be $30,000, and that includes consultation with the developer, Dr. Blaustein, monthly calls. Marie's already on some monthly calls from the state, but the cost is really minimal compared to some of the other models. And really could be done pretty quickly. There's a two-day training that we're really excited about that we can bring here, up to 100 people. I think that's a lot, so we're probably looking at 75. But we will invite many across the juvenile justice system. If we can get a judge there, that would be great. Not totally optimistic about that, but we'll get the state's attorney's office and CASA. Anybody that's involved in the juvenile justice can come and be trained on trauma-informed. And Dr. Blaustein will cater it to the juvenile justice system. So we really have an advantage there of getting this foundation within the community, truly a system of care. The consultation will be monthly, as Marie is experiencing right now, with several folks from Northwestern that are involved with this. And Dr. Blaustein is working on the train-the-trainer option, which then would allow somebody within our agency to be able to continue training in the future as opposed to always bringing someone here. This does not require using all master's level, but I want to be very clear that if we have therapy, we will use a master's level person. Marie is sitting to get her license real soon, so we'll have a clinical person that has that level as well. But what allows you to use ARC across the entire system? The Youth Assessment Center is very excited. Their staff are real excited to be a part of this. This can be used at a bachelor's level. You don't have to have a degree. You can teach parents. There's a parent curriculum. There are a lot of aspects of PLL that we're pretty excited about. Why is it not moving? There we go. And then it is allowed to coincide with other models. I think it's really interesting when you find a model that's highly evidence-based, they get a little testy about if you want to do something different. And I found that from a couple of models. And one I said, could we use group? Because that could be really effective with families that want to meet together. you can put them in support groups, but we don't really allow that in our models. And that, again, became some of the structural issues of some of the models we looked at. Although not officially a family model, it is a focused framework that is highly caretaker engagement and does have that parenting curriculum. So Marie will talk a little bit about that in a second. It is researched in the juvenile justice system. It is not evidence-based as approved yet, but Dr. Blaustein is working very hard to get it through this Family First clearinghouse and hopes within a year she'll have enough of the research and base to be able to place it there. And it truly is a strength model and resilience building as opposed to a treatment model, which automatically makes it more family-friendly to look at it from that perspective. And so here is hopefully, can I get it? There, that's good. There you go. Okay. Marie's going to step up, and this is a time that if you want to ask her questions, she's going to be way more astute to what the model is about than I am.
Good evening. It's an honor here to be with you. I'm very happy to enliven the ARC treatment framework for you. This is something that we've been very proud to include in our intensive placement stabilization program that works with DCFS-involved youth for the last year and a half. It is a truly inclusive treatment framework, not only with the skills, talents, and experiences that the therapeutic staff bring when they do their work with the families, but it's also inclusive in the way that it can be adapted to the individualized needs of children and families themselves. So there is a parenting curriculum that Pat mentioned. It's called the ARC Reflections curriculum that the Ansel Casey Foundation helped to develop with Dr. Margaret Blaustein. And it's a very accessible, step-by-step training curriculum that our staff is using with parents. We haven't used it in a group setting in our IPS program because we cover four counties. It's difficult to get parents together. But we're very excited with this new family model program that will be starting with the juvenile justice program in Champaign County, that we could create group sessions where this psychoeducation around how trauma impacts children's development and the way they make their choices, and talking about how the behaviors that you see in these children that you're trying so hard to raise up to be productive citizens, that actually their behaviors make sense. And so if we could take a minute, take a step back, stay curious, and try to think about what that child has been through and what is impacting the way that they're making their choices today, and adapting the adult responses to the child to promote the most healthy choices being made. You can see with this house model, it's sort of a roadmap. It actually gives families a lot of hope. When they meet us in our IPS team, they don't know where we've come from, but we can show them this is the map of the treatment interventions we'll be using, and this is where we start. So the bottom layer of the house is all about how we engage with the families, including all the way down to setting up the routines and rhythms with how we do our interventions with the families. And then the very next layer has to do with the attachment domain, and that is all the very first step, the caregiver affect management. That is where we empower the caregivers to have a better mindful knowing of their own needs as they're giving care to these children. So I'm very proud that that's a part of what Dr. Blaustein has included in this treatment framework, that you start with the adults first, and then we can get on to teaching the whole family skills. And then as you can see, as you move through the layers of the house, you gain the skills capacity as you go. And so in the regulation level, it's where everyone in the family is able to identify not just what they're feeling, but what they can do about it, so they can get more mastery over what's going on inside of them, so that they can make better choices outside of them. And then the final layer has to do with competence. So this is, you know, having some sense of what you've been through, what's going on, and then creating better skills and strategies to make better informed choices going forward. And that's also where we get those higher level skills of relational connection. And then the roof of the house is the goal of every intervention we do, which is trauma experience integration. And so this may be not what families are expecting to encounter when their young person has become involved with the juvenile justice system, but we hope to give them a refreshing look on how to have a hopeful look at helping their child to recover with the experiences they've been through. So that's ARC. Thanks for listening. Does anyone have questions? Thank you.
Yep. We're almost done. Okay. So, So I'm going to go through these. You've already read this. It's kind of a coordinated from the previous, and we've already talked about the system of care, the two-day coordination with the juvenile justice stakeholders, as well as across the juvenile justice system. I attended the Youth Assessment Center Advisory Board and see the potential of having a good move forward. It was good to have Lynn there and begin to talk about how many of us around that table have an interest in the juvenile justice system and possibly even could match with the behavioral health system for children and youth, and how powerful that would be to begin to look at that whole system and making an impact. We will not necessarily run wraparound, but we will support developing wraparound. That usually takes blended funding and other things that would require a system to handle, not in this grant, but certainly could support that. Have talked a lot with Regina about the peer support, and we hope to also, as a collective group, begin to look at what's already out there with services, where are their gaps, where are their needs, what else can we add to this. Our program is just a small piece of a bigger puzzle. And we will continue to explore viable models, as I mentioned. And just so you understand that the utilization of the grant will clearly be sufficient to help get this implemented. I'm going to say a little bit more bold. By February, we hope to have folks hired, could at least hopefully tag into the DCFS training and should be able to start. If we're not able to get therapists, we have three therapists and one family support person that would be a bachelor's level, which is very similar to PLL. If we can't find the therapist, another bachelor's level person could actually be added, and we would let Mark know that we've made a change and go through the process. But we have a lot more flexibility in being able to get this off the ground quickly, and that was really kind of the hallmark of that. So now we're ready.
So. Questions? Jane.
Okay, so maybe mine is more of a comment. So, you know, I'm really big on this idea of let's catch them before they're in the juvenile system. And so as much as I mean, it was a fantastic presentation. I think you guys are so on track. But just every time we said, you know, juvenile justice system, I cringed because mm-hmm. I want to catch these kids. I want to help these kids before they've got that label. So I know that that's kind of the target. That's probably where the greatest need is. But I don't want us to not look at the ones who have not, unfortunately, hit that threshold.
Excellent point. And I'll bring up a couple and ask Marie to step in if she has more about ARC. But in particular, we're going to start with the Youth Assessment Center group of youth. They have not been adjudicated. This will not be a diversionary program that is court-ordered. So it really has nothing. It's going to be much more of what kind of support can we give the families. So we're starting there. We will also look at Mike Williams' group of youth that have been through it and be able to help, so we can support that. ARC is clearly goes into early childhood. So there are components that can be used very early on. So again, we can't do all in one program, but we can begin to develop that need, and probably I could see even in the second year being able to bring some of these concepts to very earlier. We also, by our design in the committee, as well as this group, has decided age 10 is what we're looking at, age 10 to 17. Those children will almost never, or not never, but almost never, hit that adjudicatory. It's going to be maybe seen by a resource officer in the school that this child's having some issues. So we are able to begin to put the infrastructure in place, but we want to start with the group that we have the most support with, that PLL was mostly designed for, is that YAC group of the youth assessment. But clearly this can be and will be the intent of exploring further. With the parent curriculum, that in particular is really, really helpful as a psychoeducation to understand early childhood dynamics. That may be something that needs to be looked at, and how you look at behaviors in a very different way. We had a really good conversation. I think it was Chandra. It was one of the earlier ones. That we have to define behavior not as juvenile delinquency. We have to define it as behaviors that is a sign of something else. And that's what this model clearly does. It really has to shift the system to understand what this really is. And if we start with those kids that are more emerging needs right now, but not in the system yet, and then begin to look at the other ends, that's really where we see this going in the future. Great question.
So this may be actually more someone else can answer, but the Youth Assessment Center, who all are they servicing? I mean, obviously Champaign-Urbana, but are they hitting kids in Thomasboro, kids in Homer? I'm sure Rantoul, because they have resource officers, they're referring kids. But again, you know, I look at where my knowledge is, where, you know, the ground roots of rural mom here of, are we referring those kids to the Youth Assessment Center? And if we are they taking them? So
that I don't know for sure, but I will also say we plan to have offices. We have an office already in Rantoul. We will have an office probably either through the schools where YAC is talking about. They have now, their folks are in the schools. I think they already are or will be in Rantoul. They're going to be in Mahomet. They just signed a contract there. So they are trying to be in the schools. So I can't imagine that wouldn't be something supportive of, I don't know where they're at now. Marie, did you have something else to say?
We just met with the YAC case managers today, and they did talk about how each case manager is assigned to a school district. And they also talked about how they are covering the surrounding school districts that have nothing to do with Champaign-Urbana. And they each talked about who they cover. And it was really encouraging to see and hear that. So I'm glad you spoke up. And then we talked a lot about how whatever families they're touching, we want to be able to touch as well. And we talked about ways to problem solve accessibility if there's a distance from with the community-based locations we've been designing and how we can problem solve that, including looking at help with transportation needs or possibly even remote delivery of service closer to their home area. Thank you.
Thank you. Julian?
I was curious. I was interested in what you said about some of the models you looked at being excluding certain parents or families. And could you elaborate just a little bit on what the families you're expecting to serve will be like in terms of, I'm particularly curious about cooperation and commitment and how that happens, because I'm imagining some children identified might not have the most cooperative families in the world. So I'm just curious how you're handling that.
I'm smiling because I don't know of any child that's ever wanted to come to residential. And I've been doing that for 40 years. And so a lot of it is people like Marie who know to say to a kid, you know, I'm not so much worried about punishing you. That isn't what we're about. And it's about, I really care for you and I want to know what you need right now and where you want to go. It's the approach. And I was pretty shocked by some of the models. There was the MDTF or FT actually said, we started training in, I don't know, somewhere on the East Coast. And they said, well, and the clinicians we're training don't have really MDFT families that really work very well, and they're supposed to be doing this consultation. So fitting has to do with sometimes that engagement and what the model thinks it looks like. I just tend to believe you go with where the child and family are, and you're going to talk to them at what their needs are. Doing a trauma-informed model, we're very conscientious and hyper-vigilant about one thing in particular. This is juvenile justice and more behavioral stuff, so we don't want the family to feel like they have traumatized, because it does have a bent on the child welfare system. So we're going to be really careful about hearing where the family's coming from. If you saw the house, it was a lot of engagement. What Marie isn't able to spend a lot of time on is a lot of the activities. There's actual activity sheets, very specific guidelines on what you can use to try to engage family. We clearly want to work with Regina's group. If there's a family that's not trusting us because of just who we represent, then we need to get Regina's group involved, and that's very early on. And it may be in the middle that her team needs to be, and maybe at the end as we're transitioning out. So it's hard for me to answer, but since I've lived in the residential world so long and I really don't know of too many kids that said, I really am happy to be here, we've worked with families and children that's just, you just have to have a heart to say that we're here to help, and we're ready where you are, and we're ready to go with you on that journey. And that's the best I can answer. And I think ARC probably has one of the best models, which is why Cunningham actually picked it about 5 years ago to help frame some kind of a family view, because it really forced us to say, you know, it's not about us, it's not about our program, it's not about our model. It truly is about listening to that family.
Thank you.
Yeah.
If you don't mind me adding a comment, would that be We find that listening to the interests of the families and giving them a chance to drain off their emotions when they tell their family stories decreases resistance. And then the ARC model really puts a lot of emphasis on the caregiving system. So any adult that touches that child's life is a part of the caregiving system, and all of those needs and capacities are important as well. And what I'm really proud of is that the ARC treatment framework also includes a caregiver crisis plan for just for the caregiver, of looking at what are their own needs, what are their own triggers, who are the people they can turn to, and that's one of the first interventions we do with families. So yes, we encounter resistant parents in our IPS program, for example, but when they see our approach about caring about every level of the family, it really promotes buy-in. So thank you.
Thank you, Elaine.
As you know, I'm sure one of our problems with PLL was that it ended up not serving very many people for the amount of money we were spending. So I just wonder if you have any sense from everyone you've talked to of how many people you might be serving, how many families, what your capacity is.
How many right now is a caseload for a therapist at IPS?
15 is the max, ideally.
So 10 to 15 is what we would be looking at per therapist. And so if you put in a 3 to 9 month intervention, which would average to 6, so that's my administrative hat that kind of goes in. So it really is by your caseload. And if you have a real, the front is usually the most intense. So once you get, the first part of the program will be probably 25 before the end of June, simply because we haven't hired up yet. We're still training people. But we're anticipating a 10 to 15, and it's possible once you get into an algorithm of people coming in, going out, and it has some kind of rhythm, and that's usually the second or third year, quite frankly, and then it could be even higher than that. And if we're able to use more bachelor's level folks, and it becomes more of the needs of the family is less about a clinical approach, and it's more about getting more of their basic needs and some other things, or supporting in the school, that things look very different, and wraparound begins to come in play in the system, then you're making a bigger difference on more families, and that capacity will grow.
Well, and hopefully you'll have less sibling groups. You know, if you're
we've heard there's a lot of sibling groups. That is something that's really interesting.
I love the
yes.
idea of caring for the caregiver. Mm-hmm. I have a different situation, but sometimes I'm like, who's caring for me and my mentally ill son?
Right.
It's me caring for him, you know, but I love that, and so maybe – like you said, you're not going to see that data right away, but maybe in a few years you have less sibling groups needing some kind of
resources. What we heard from Ramona and Julia, that you know that this kid's in trouble now, and we're seeing something coming with this kid, and if you can work with that whole family, you are meeting some of the needs of those maybe usually younger kids. Yeah.
Chandra?
I took a bathroom break, so somebody may have already spoke to this. But, Jane, I wanted to speak to something that you said where you talked about the rural areas. Stigma is huge out there. If people do not believe they need help or do not believe that they want support from where supports or services are available, they're not going to get them. So I encourage everyone to raise the awareness, especially as everyone here being champions for mental wellness. Spread the word that this support is here in our community. Half of the battle of why supports are not used is because people are not sharing that they're actually available for the community. And so if we look at raising the awareness and addressing the stigma associated with getting the help, that doesn't mean you're a bad parent. It doesn't mean that you are a bad caregiver. It really just means that you're getting some additional support to have your children or your family be successful. And whatever success is that's defined by the family, not necessarily the provider. So I just encourage our rural area people who are out there to say, hey, there are services and supports. People will come to you, and then once that connection is made, then more people will actually take it on.
Any other comments? Kyle?
I guess I need more clarity. When you say it's not a family model, like, is that it can be used as a family model or as not? So there's, okay.
It's not designed only for families. You could work with the youth. And even in this model, if the family didn't want to engage with PLL, you had to have an engaged family member. This one, you really wouldn't have to. We also have an opportunity, maybe Hope Springs, where our counseling center is, if that might be a better approach with one with that child. It just allows you more flexibility. Or maybe you start with the family and then you continue with the youth. I mean, it just really allows for more flexibility.
And you all are currently using it with, you said, the IPS program?
Yes.
And are you using it in a family model in that program? Okay.
As a family model, yes. That's why we became more excited about it. We hadn't really used it that way before, and so it just makes sense that it is very user-friendly for families.
With the PLL program, I know there is an aspect of it that the foundation that ran the program provided ongoing technical support. Is there any aspect of this program that would have something similar?
For the consultation, yes, that's monthly, and we could probably continue that in perpetuity if we want to. That might be a part of the grant that we would keep, is to keep those developers involved with us. I think the other part of the technical support, and I'm going to look to Mark a little bit, is probably with data, other things that they were able to help with. And that's, you know, that's the downside. That's the top part of the evidence base. A lot of the cost has to do with the time the therapist needs to have supervision, which one model is every other week, 30 to 90 minutes per case. And when you're trying to get capacity, that really influences that. Mm-hmm. It takes time to do. If you want a lot of quality data that's research-based, you need to spend a lot of time putting data in. And so that's the kind of stuff that I kind of knew it, but when you get into it, it's like, whoa, that. And then you look at implementation. It would take a lot of time and take away from your capacity.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, I just want to thank you guys for taking this project on. I mean, in general, I've been really impressed with Cunningham Children's Home and how you guys in multiple ways are trying to fill voids in the community. You've been really focused and effective at that. That's all I got. Thanks.
This is why I didn't want to take a couple years off from the board, because I'm so excited about this. First of all, that it's a strength-based model is so important. Second, I think you're so realistic in saying we do not need all master level therapists. Well, I know we need that for the therapy part because I know my social workers at the U of I would kill me for saying that. But in the real world, we need to utilize bachelor level individuals to accomplish things. I'm excited that you're working with Nicole and the evaluation piece. I think that's so helpful. And all of the staff's involved in it. And one of the things when you were talking about prevention, I think as a parent, my kids are all grown up, but parenting is so tough. I don't care if you have an LCSW like I did. It's still the toughest job in the world. And I think any resources that we have for people, they're out there. And as long as people know they're out there, that hopefully to encourage individuals to utilize. So thank you so much. Thank you. Okay, so now we're, Mark, do you want to talk about the decision memorandum, please?
I wanted to be sure we did not skip that. Okay. Yes, as part of the contract, and basically you've heard the presentation, the planning phase is coming to a close. In order for Cunningham to move forward with implementation, to start hiring and looking at the training requirements, as part of the contract, they were, they've been keeping the board informed, but the board needs to endorse the specific model that's been presented, which is ARC. Essentially, for them to move forward, the board needs to approve them. The use of the ARC, so, and that's what the decision memo is addressing. I would also point out that the planning phase has been a very minor cost in terms of the overall cost of this particular contract, and that the majority of the funds will be put towards the hiring and implementation, and obviously at the end of the contract year that would be reconciled and you know, through the audit process, the financial process. And we did discuss the question of whether or not they wanted to come forward with a two-year proposal, and the preference was to stay with the single-year contract, and then based on what they'll have enough information to base an application on for the next year, that they will come forward in January with an application for the second year of this program.
Thank you. So on page 6, do I have a motion? Comments first.
I move to approve use of the ARC model for Cunningham Children's Home as recommended by the stakeholders work group per terms of the parenting model planning implementation contract.
Okay, I think we need, Stephanie, do you want to do roll call for, comments, sorry. Julian?
Short question, I'm not sure if you know this yet, or maybe it's obvious. What are you anticipating as cost going forward? I mean, I'm not asking you for an exact number, but what's your sense of how expensive this is going to be in the future?
I don't see it is what it is right now. Once it's in play, then it's just a matter of, do you want 3 more therapists and 1 bachelor's, and do we find bachelor's levels being more effective? I don't see a lot, because the training is mostly consultation. We may bring, maybe we'll bring training every 2 years, but it's $30,000 for the start. Even if it was that, it's way less than the PLL program was. And then hopefully you're building continuity. I just think we're more so, the size would be not too much bigger for this particular program in some ways because of the capacity of workforce issues. And I won't go into that part of it here, but that really is a play of it, its part. And how can other services begin to fill in gaps as opposed to just this program? You should have a lot more options within your juvenile justice system. And so I don't see it being that much more in terms of...
Yeah, I didn't want you to commit to anything. I was just wondering what you were thinking about.
Yeah, maybe double, that would be the most I could see, but if it became more prevention, that would probably look quite different.
Kyle?
I was actually going to say this earlier, but it slipped my mind. I'd heard that there had been discussion of, as Cunningham starts expanding doing more community service to either change the name or operate community service under a different name. And I just want to say I really strongly encourage you guys to do that, particularly when we're talking about a program that is going to have families that already come with a lot of stigma to this. Like, you know, I'm Italian, I grew up here at Cunningham Children's Home. It's associated so closely with DCFS.
Right.
And
right.
For people, particularly people who are of color, low income, who have children who are having issues, DCFS means the people who take your kids.
You're right.
So I think that, particularly for this program, it would be really beneficial.
Right. It's on our strategic plan. We just talked about that in September. And right now we put a program of Cunningham Children's Home really small, and we talked about the next step needing to be discussed, and we've brought that before our board as well. So point well taken. I'll take that back. Thanks.
Thanks, Kyle, for that suggestion. Stephanie, we need a roll call for this, so... guess we'll go ahead and vote if you approve this, the roll call. Thanks.
Elaine Palencia?
Yes.
Kyle Patterson?
Yes.
Julian Rappaport?
Yes.
Jane Sprandel?
Yes.
Joe Omoasagie?
Yes.
Margaret White?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Okay, we move to the 2-year contract.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks. Thanks.
Can I do my playground whistle?
You can declare victory.
Oh, it's so exciting. Thank you so much. All right, so now we're on agenda item B. The 2-year term contract extensions, this is page 16 to 19. Mark, do you want to briefly? I think you did this one, right?
I think it's Lynn was
okay.
the lead on
I
this.
I got the Lynn.
I did
Sorry.
A little kind of support work.
So, all right, yeah. So I'll have Lynn do that. Sorry.
This is a true collaboration.
You're next.
I'm sorry, I didn't
your
put
C.
Mark's name on this. This is not the most glamorous thing in the board packet, not the most glamorous thing we've ever done. I was quite surprised at how many agencies said, yes, we would take an extension of the contract, because what they're giving up is the option of asking for more money in the coming year. So I thought, okay, we were pretty confident that these programs are solid. You've funded them for a while. We do not have any huge compliance issues. We have good relationships with these. So if you are, even when I try to make a simple decision memo, it really does need a navigator. So toward the bottom of page 17, it says these obligations total $1,612,538. So that's the amount of money that you would be obligating if you agree to this from next year's agency grant allocation dollars. That leaves you, and this is always an estimate, and this is a very conservative estimate, the amount that goes to DD programs, which per the intergovernmental agreement is about 600, it's in here, 696,137 is the amount to spend next year. You made very clear a couple of weeks ago what kind of DD programs you're interested in next year, so we'll get to that a little bit later in the meeting, but this is the amount of money per the agreement between the DD board and the mental health board, which is also already obligated. So that leaves you for this open, competitive application process that you're looking at starting in February, about $2,321,716 to allocate, to make decisions about, to review applications, and then, you know, it probably will be a lot more money than that, but right now I wanted to give you a safe estimate. So this is the biggest damage done. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So on page 18, do I have someone who will make a motion?
Terms of each, thank you, contract listed above, from June 30th, 2020 to June 30th, 2021, and to increase each contract's maximum by an amount equal to the original contract amount, with the exception noted, as recommended.
Kyle, second. Comments, concerns? Kyle?
As far as budget impact goes, there's not really a cost, correct?
Correct.
Okay, because there's a lot of words and you said a lot of things, but I was a little confused.
But it does, it's a change in your flexibility mm-hmm. during the spring.
Yeah, so we're looking at less dollars to allocate sort of each year, but there's not going to be any sort of added expense.
And I think we've talked about this at each memo and at each iteration of this project, that there's language in the contracts already about getting out of contracts for reasons which are outside of this. So.
Julian?
Okay. So I'm in favor of this, but I'm trying to figure this out. I thought part of the reason we're doing this is in some ways, what it does is eliminate unnecessary work for both the agencies and for the board, freeing us all up to do other things and maybe do things more carefully in other domains, because it's a lot of work involved. I somehow had in my head that we were going to try to stagger this in such a way, because I can't figure out what happens if these are all due at the same time.
What you talked about, we can't do it because we're bound by the funding guidelines and by the current year priorities document, but you can start doing that next year with your
okay.
next set of decisions.
So that's just what I want to get, make sure I understand that, because it seems to me one big advantage would go away if we have to review everything now only, you know, all at once. So that's your planning toward staggering this in the future. Is that what I'm understanding?
If the board directs us to stagger these, then we would figure that out. But right now, we just, all of the language about multi-year contracts says two-year terms. So we can't do a three-year term. So the only way to do it is hold some things as a one-year term. We've never done this before, so we don't actually know what's going to happen in the spring.
I'm willing to, 100% willing to take your advice on implementation. No. I just wanted to get mind the intention over time.
If you want us to do that, I think that we can do that. We haven't got there yet, but one assumption that I think we all need to be prepared for, finding out we are wrong, is that we might end up with a lot of applications to look at, and they would all be new-ish, that might be really exciting, and I'm sure we're all down for that, but it wouldn't change the workload like we sort of hope it would. You know.
Well, there's a I'm sorry. Can I comment back here? It's part of what we're doing here is saying, though, there are certain activities like re-reviewing programs that are consistent and that we've already liked and they're going on, and that we don't necessarily have to review them every year with the same detail. That's what we're accomplishing here, I think. Yeah. And they don't have to do as much work. As frequently.
That's real.
Yeah, I know it's real. So that's it. Great. Thank you.
Any other comments?
I was just going to point out that the $1.6 million that we would be moving to a second year contract automatically. In the past, we've kind of talked about a leapfrogging process where about one third of the contracts are get extended for a year, go to have a two-year term, and two-thirds are up for consideration. And we're actually fairly close to that with the way this actually breaks out. So you could put this on two-year contracts. We could do allocations in May if we so chose, put those on a two-year contract, and then or I guess a third of those on two-year contracts. So that everything comes up. But we haven't looked at that in any depth, or I haven't anyway. And I just recall that from several years ago when we initially talked about two-year contracts and how we might approach it. And that was one of the things I always had in the back of my mind. So.
One thing then we'd have to decide, you would have to decide, is to do that, to take the two-thirds that are remaining and then take half of those and put them on a two-year contract, means that you don't necessarily hold to the criteria that we used here about stable contracts with a long history or that haven't changed very much. So it's a different, but you can do that. You can do whatever you want.
We can invent criteria as long as the programs know it ahead of time and that we follow it for everybody. I mean, you know, follow. So, yes, I don't see that as a problem. Yeah.
Thank you for all of your work on this. This is very exciting. And I, like Julian said, it will help both your office and the agencies because a lot of agencies have they're one-person agencies, and this is Okay. So, Stephanie, will you do roll call, please?
Joe Omoasage?
Yes.
Elaine Palencia?
Yes.
Kyle Patterson?
Yes.
Julian Rappaport?
Yes.
James Brandel?
Yes.
Margaret White?
Yes.
The next is the 3-year plan. With the FY 2020 objectives. This is page 20 through 28. And Mark, do you want to talk about the decision memorandum, please?
Sure. Basically, we're in the second year of our plan, our current 3-year plan period. It was presented, there were, I guess, some proposed changes presented in September. We didn't get much comment on those specific changes. There was a little bit of wordsmithing that occurred in response to some input we received. And then we had the two study sessions where we talked about criteria, but that also kind of also extends into, and particularly the September study session, into the three-year plan. And there was discussion and points raised during certainly the September study session that as staff, we listened, we heard what was said, and we added additional objectives to the plan to reflect that. And those specific additions have been, are referenced in the decision memo. You'd have to refer back to the actual plan to see them, and I can speak to those if you care to. But we are looking for action to approve the plan and move it forward. Let's see. Under goal number one, I might actually have two redundant references there. Actually, it's goal number, under goal number one, objective 7 and 8 are both new. I refer to the same objective in the decision memo, so I apologize that. Then we added an objective under goal number 3, objective 6, and then there was one edit that was made. So goal number 3, objective 6. Explore the feasibility of co-locating services in neighborhoods, community centers. That's something that's been discussed and refers back to improving access in the community. And then the two objectives under goal number one, increase providers' understanding of the value of setting internal goals for advancing program performance outcome evaluation. I think that was a response to the presentation we had from Nicole Allen at our September board meeting, and that the response of agencies to the evaluation support that they're receiving. So we have an existing objective related to building evaluation capacity within agencies, and then objective 7 is internalizing that within the agencies. And then the last one is relates to a subject that I don't think a day goes by that we don't hear about, the issue of workforce shortage. Pat, in her presentation this evening, alluded to some of the issues that exist in the community. We were on a conference call today talking about that, and Lynn was in a meeting yesterday where it was a pretty significant discussion. So anyway, those were the changes we made to the three-year plan, to the objectives, and looking for approval to move forward with it. So, thank you.
Thank you. Do I have a motion, please? Page 20.
I move to approve page 20. Okay. It's been a long day. I move to approve the three-year plan for fiscal years 2019 through 2021 with fiscal year 2020 objectives.
Jane, second. Okay, all in favor? Oh, we have to, go ahead.
Two things. Sorry.
Sorry, that was my fault. I was supposed to say that.
I thought I had to wait until it was on the floor. Maybe
no, you did right. You did the right thing. I didn't. Thanks.
I'm not exactly sure what outside a number, that objective number 5, you mentioned it in your introductory letter to this, objective number 5 of goal 1, is it goal 1? Yeah. What does that mean, outside of a therapeutic environment? I don't know what the phrase means. Just clarify for me.
We're talking about outside of a behavioral health center, right? Outside of a clinical setting.
You mean formal therapy, or I mean, there's something about the idea. Therapeutic environments don't have to be a therapist providing for an environment to be therapeutic. So I don't quite understand, like, what that means. I mean, maybe it doesn't matter a lot.
Well, what we're trying to get to is really easy. It's so simple, and I think we haven't captured it, but it is. That we understand the value of peer supports, especially when they're not governed by a behavioral health provider, when they're outside of that.
I understand that.
Yeah, that's all we meant.
My objection would be to think that that means that they're outside of a therapeutic environment, because they actually, you know, it could be more therapeutic. I don't want to turn this into a whole big thing now. So
there was actually a comment because we had proposed that it be traditional, outside of a traditional therapeutic environment, and we got questions about that. So we were inserting traditional as a new, I guess, in addition to this particular objective, and it was questioned, and we talked about that internally and decided, well, that didn't exist there before. We will take that out because we've gotten the question about that, because it then became, does that imply about non-traditional? What does that imply in relation to non-traditional? So we just took that out. If you would be more comfortable without any reference at all to outside of a therapeutic environment, we can just strike that whole, that
would, I know you have maybe more questions. So what's happening is Medicaid will only reimburse for peer support services by a certified recovery support specialist in a setting like a certified community behavioral health center. But we also know that the evidence shows that's a less effective setting for them to operate, and that's just established. So there are people in this community who are in their own peer support organizations, independent, getting that certification for no other reason than to say, we understand how to do this work. And that, I think that would make it that's also a nice reason to pay them to do the work, because they've gotten the certification. Whereas Medicaid would pay for it if they were in the other setting, and then you wouldn't pay for it. So that's the whole reason this is in here. But I think what Mark said would work for me.
I don't know what to say. So,
Kyle?
Would a word like, instead of therapeutic, clinical, make more sense? Because are we basically saying, like, support groups that meet at, like, a church or a VFW as opposed to, like, Rosecrans or a hospital? Is that? Yeah. So I don't know if, because I totally agree with Julian that the language is a little off, and that it sounds like it's like a, like a really problematic, like, therapeutic model or something. No, I mean, I don't think we should abandon the clause, but maybe outside of a traditional, I don't know.
I objected to that because that opens you to the word non-traditional, which can be all kinds of nutty stuff that somebody thinks up that has no evidence or anything that it works. So I think when you say non-traditional, that brings in the possibility of magical thinking and all kinds.
So I'm a little concerned. Here's my concern is, for me it would work to substitute clinical, by the way, because what I'm concerned about, you know, we currently support things like this anyway, somehow referring to them as not therapeutic seems wrong.
Well, I mean, when we use the word environment in this, we're talking about like a physical brick and mortar environment, right? Or no? Am I not understanding? So the word environment can be something that is about the quality of something, or it can be about like a physical location. If we can differentiate that we mean the latter, I think that would clear it up.
Or could we say vote on this in a modified form and say changing that to outside of a clinical setting? Because
it's okay with me.
Thank you all for working through that.
So if we modified when we vote, we could vote the motion, but modified with outside of a clinical setting.
Yeah.
Okay. Does that, well, okay.
Do we have to do something formal now?
We need to, if there are not any other comments, we need to vote.
I have one other question.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, you know, I can't help myself, right?
No.
You know, this is such interesting reading that, you know, you're getting...
It's
community engagement and advocacy, objective number one, lists a number of things having to do with acceptance, inclusion, respect, and so on. I notice, probably not, page 27, community engagement and advocacy. I guess it's goal 9, sorry. Objective 1. I just wanted to know, does not listing Ebertfest have any implications? Since, as you know, I've been a fan of Ebertfest and what we do there.
I think it's included under other related community education events.
Well, why are we naming all these other things and
maybe
not
we should,
naming
do
that?
We need to name any, we vote on that every year. Where do we vote on the other ones?
I
wonder
no
if we set ourselves up by adding something.
These are just 1 year of practice.
Yeah. Oh.
Does this really matter, though?
Yeah.
I just don't want to arrive at a situation where we're making decisions about these things, and I'm told that, oh, guess what? We didn't say that one as one of our goals. We said all these other ones. Or so, you know, I just want to.
But we voted, this is a 1 year thing, and we've already voted on it for this year. So it wouldn't be excluded.
I'm not sure I followed that, but. Don't ask me. You understand what I'm asking, so.
The board has, I think Margaret's point, if I'm following you, is that the board has already approved the investment in Ebertfest for 2020.
And since these are 1 year goals,
not really.
Yeah, that's what.
Goals.
Well, the objectives are essentially 1 year.
I think the important aspect of this is that the real decision on whether or not Ebertfest happens is when we vote on our allocation. So, I mean, I get what you're saying, but that's where the real decision point's at as far as having authority over that, so.
Is that not true for these other things?
Yeah.
Well, then the point stays the same.
I would probably have a tendency to agree with Kyle is since we're going to vote on them later and we'd review other related.
I don't know. I don't remember you ever voting on the expo. Like, that's before my time. It's in the budget, and it's in several places in the budget, so we discuss it with the budget. Okay. So, okay. The other thing is Mental Health Awareness Day is free.
I'm afraid to ask for other comments.
Well, how about saying, for example, as opposed to, because this reads to me like we're saying this is what we're doing. It reads to me like a declarative commitment. I'm being sensitive about this because this question of Ebertfest has come up every year.
Right. I'm going to be gone, so it probably won't.
Every year we
have
a conversation about it.
Well,
and
for
it never gets settled. So.
Well, we do put a lot of energy into the expo and to Ebertfest. So we are definitely, we're already doing them. I mean, we've started working on both. So
the I have to repeat myself then. Why isn't it listed here?
Right. Because this was drafted before you voted on Ebertfest. And we could sure add it.
I'd say either add it or just say, for example, whichever is easier.
Yeah, do both. Because it's
fine.
Semantic statement.
I still think we're already covering other places. But if we need to put Ebertfest in there, we put it in.
Okay, so now we will vote on the motion with the modification of clinical setting for objective five, or goal one, objective five, and then in on page, what page was it again? 27, we'll change the term to, we'll add Ebertfest, such as all of those Ebert, and include Ebertfest. So, do I need an individual roll call on this? Do we need a, okay. So, okay. Yes. All right. So now we're going to vote on the three-year plan with the FY 2020 objectives modified in the clinical setting and adding Ebertfest. So, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, thank you.
Thank you for caring about this.
Okay. Well, I always say thanks for reading everything, because that's key for when people do all this work. All right, so the next in line is page 29. This is the allocation priorities and decision criteria. And so I think we'll look at page 39. We'll start this and say, do I have a motion? And then we'll go with comments. Page 39. Elaine? Okay, comments, concerns?
Believe it or not, I don't have any.
Okay. I'm thinking hashtag grateful. all right. So all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? I'm just teasing. So it makes this fun. Okay. The next one is, thank you, the allocation criteria, which is on pages 40 to 50. So oh, okay. So we just don't need that one.
So, well, I wanted to tell you something.
Okay. Lynn.
We like to include these for you for your information anyway, but I want to tell you that your discussions about priorities had a big impact on the DDB's priorities memo, too.
All right. Thank you. The next is agency information. All right. Now, old business, there are schedules and the allocation process timeline. They're included in pages 51 to 54. And I think we're, we may not need our meeting December 18th. So my comment would be, is everybody okay with that? Discussion. Well, we'll decide now. We will decide tonight. So
there are other things that we could talk about in December, but we could also wait till January to talk about them. Would you rather? Okay.
Okay. So let's wait. Yeah. All right. So the plan is that in the schedules and allocation process, we have deleted the December 18th meeting. Thank you. CCDDB board information?
They had a meeting this morning and did some of the same business that you all are doing. They will have a December 18th meeting because a couple of things that they talked about today that are important that need to be finished by the end of the year are this first time ever mini grant individual application process. This is the response was pretty overwhelming. We're trying to figure out, can more money be spent on it? Because some of the applications might be to the review committee. They might really want to fund more than we originally started with. These are all issues that remain to be discussed. So that has to happen in December. Hopefully they'll also be able to make decisions about those awards. The other order of business is that, sadly, another DD agency went out of business and stopped providing a valuable service in this community. So that leaves about 20 people without the service and some money not spent. So even though it's not a huge amount of money, they had a pretty big discussion today about what are we going to do for those people. So they'll meet again in December to hopefully make some progress on that. They started a plan today. I know it's a short turnaround time, but they might be able to make some decisions in December. So that's, otherwise they did what you all have been doing. It was the UCP. The agency went out of business. They were acquired by another company, which is Spark, which keeps its offices in all other communities except here. So they just closed down here completely. But of the 20 people being served at that office, they are known. They have case managers. We're going to work with their case managers to figure out what's the right thing to do for them next with the small amount of money that's available. But so that's, for that reason, they'll be meeting in December.
Approval of the minutes. So I need a motion to approve the October 23rd minutes. Okay, all in favor? Okay, thank you. Approval of the October 30th minutes. Kyle? Joe second, all in favor? Aye. I'm going to skip on mentioning staff reports because I want to make sure we have an action item with the financial report on 78 to 84, please. Okay, do I have a motion to accept the expenditure list? And
so moved.
Julian? Second, Jane, all in favor?
Aye.
All right, so I'm going to skip back to staff reports. They're in our packet. I would encourage you to read them. I want to bring up two things on it, and one is this is upcoming. Chandra, I don't know who's teaching. Are you teaching all of them? The mental health first aid class, if you have not taken it, I actually took it from another agency, and it is outstanding. I would recommend it to anyone. It's CEUs, Joe. CEUs are available, which are wonderful, but the knowledge, even as a therapist, I'm thinking just remembering what do you do. And we're all in situations in life with people that are struggling. And then what do we do? And the great thing about the mental health first aid, it's for everybody. Just a fantastic information. So the dates are December 13th to 20th for adults. And January, go ahead.
So just to let you know, you have to do both dates. Because we're not doing 8-hour days. We're breaking it up 4 hours, 4 hours. Joe is in the last 8-hour day. It was a long day.
All right.
So we're going to do the adult version, and then in January we'll do the youth.
Okay.
What's the time?
9 to 1:30.
I've just been recommending it to everybody. It's just, it's a fantastic class. So thank you. And thank you to the staff for all of their
work. I have one more thing to say, if that's okay. On December 5th, the students will be doing like their final presentation. So you are welcome to come. So they were going to come and do their PowerPoint here, but since we had so much business to do and they were going to come later, we decided to just save it for the 5th. It will be here at 9 o'clock. But, yes, all of the trainings are here in Jenny Putman room.
And the presentation.
And the presentation.
But you have a tough choice to make that day because in my office, also December 5th from 9 to 11, a group of students from social work are going to be talking about their findings related to burnout and turnover in the field and their recommendations for workforce recruitment and retention strategies. So you have a very, very tough. Good news is both of these will be on presentations which are electronic and shareable.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you. Make sure I cover. So thank you, staff, for your reports. Board-to-board reports. Oh, Kyle?
I had two things I wanted to mention. Today I actually took time off work and went to the drug court graduation. I saw Lynn there. I don't know if you saw me. She was late. I was already sitting down.
I wasn't.
But you went.
But it was the first time I had went, and it was, I mean, I didn't really know what to expect, but it was really nice experience. Judge Ford kind of puts into perspective how long the program's been going on and just kind of what it's about, and you got to hear directly from the people who are graduating, and so it was a really good experience. And then also I wanted to mention that HBO has a new documentary right now called Ernie and Joe, Crisis Cops, and it is about these two CIT officers in San Antonio, I believe. And I mean, I felt it was really good. It does a good job at showing what it actually looks like. It, you know, it has footage of them doing actual crisis calls. And you know, a lot of the times we don't always get to see the impact firsthand of the things that we fund. And I know that that has been a big push in this community to get more CIT-trained officers. And it does a really good job at showing how CIT conflicts with the traditional model of policing. I can't remember the phrase they have, but it's like three words in quick succession that it's like, do it right now, I'll make you. Or so there's something that I can't remember what it was, but they're saying it's a traditional approach and how they just radically sort of change that. So I really recommend for all you social elites with HBO subscriptions to, I'm looking at you, Julian.
I was going to mention the same thing, actually, when board-to-board reports, because I went to the meeting that Mark goes to, also at the CIT meeting, and I, you know, I always think it's great that we get together with the police and these social service agencies. Watching this, if you really want to see, they're a whole level in terms of implementation beyond where we are. I mean, and they have so many people doing it, and they have it so systematic and so, but we're on the continuum. But it's really worth watching this documentary if you want to understand like what it's about. There's one scene which I'm holding my breath watching these two policemen approach a woman standing ready to jump off of a bridge, and how, I mean, I was just amazed. They were just so good at it, and so anyway, they saved lives, I think. So
Joe,
I mean, it's worth seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone through the local CIT training, and at Parkland, we used to do CIT training, counselors and police officers at the same time, but lately we've not done that, and we've seen at least, for my part, it seems it's escalated. And I think we all ought to be open to just being part of a CIT training itself, because it gives the community that we live in a better sense of how we can de-escalate a lot of situations.
I think this also is a good segue into thanking people we know that are in those tough situations, acknowledging how hard their jobs are, and to say thanks. Okay, thanks for your comments on that. I don't have HBO. But I think my kids do, and I'm over there a lot, yeah. So okay.
You just got to get their login information, yeah. And it's like the reverse model of how you usually.
See, and I wouldn't do, like, I would be like, oh, that would be, I couldn't do that. I know I should be able to, but I'll go to their house and watch it. Okay. I want to thank everyone and thank you. This has been a great experience. So, from somebody who didn't want to come on this board but did it as a favor for somebody, talked me into it.
And then you didn't want to be president, but you did it.
No. Yeah, I did it. So, thanks.
You did
thanks.
A great job.
And my last comment would be go Illini. Thanks. I feel like we have with, I think I'm so excited about Cunningham. I am so excited that we looked into what are the cost of things and are they really making a difference? And I think that's so important to always think about that. Is this, are we helping people in the community and what's the cost and can somebody do it more, not just cost of, well, I guess cost effectiveness. Can they do it with compassion and make sure that we're completing the task, but also looking at how do you get the best, you know, the best program for the money? So, and I appreciate Pat talked to everybody. She was so intent and asked all the questions that we needed to ask. So I'm grateful for that. But thanks. So you'll see me. I'll still be around because I love this stuff. I just need to do my own personal helping people next year. But thanks. I need to adjourn. Thanks.